Today is the 20th of May 2016. I'm interviewing Mr. Jack Morrison of Hastings on the life and times of his family. Jack, would you like to now tell me something about your family, where it started and everything?
Well, will I start with me first?
No, start with your family.
My family?
Because we had to have your family before you came.
Well, God only knows where that goes from. My father was Sid Morrison. My mother was Olive Isabel Morrison. In latter years, she lived in Galeen Street, and prior to that, in many other places in Hastings. The predominant memories I have of childhood and at home was in Queen Street, Hastings, just prior to King Street, travelling east down Queen Street. And Percy Gibson's Bowser Station used to be on the corner. Hector Jones's was on the opposite corner. Lonan Merck, or one of those agricultural type places, is where Countdown is now. Totally different building.
Hawke's Bay Farmers were on the other end of Hector Jones.
I'm not so sure. Oh, yes, on yes. Queen Street. But across the road from Hector Jones's, there's a building there. I think the Member of Parliament's got the one on the corner, and that's always been there, as far as I know. It's a hell of a lot older than I thought it was, but
well,
never.
A lot of us went there to the dentist.
Yeah, I can say Bob White was on the other end. Bloody good dentist. I always remember the story of Bob White, a very attractive woman, went in to have her teeth looked at or whatever. He said, God, he says, you're a beautiful looking bitch. She walked out.
Oh, he would have had a twinkle in his eye when he said it too.
And he was a bloody hard dude.
Yes, I knew him quite well, and his son Jerome.
Bob White used to arrive in the dark and go home in the dark, and he had a Panther motorbike, and those were the days when petrol was petrol, and he used to leave his motorbike on Queen Street or somewhere there, and some clever bugger worked out how they could siphon his tank dry, and so he got the old man to make a couple of tins on the side of the bike, looking like parcel boxes that he could fill up with petrol, and it had a Panther transfer on it, and underneath the washing was Panther piss. That was Bob White. But he used to apparently come to work in the dark and go home in the dark. And those were the days when people, to my mind, had an interest in their job.
So you were born in Hastings and you went off...
I was born in Grays Road. The building is still there, on the corner of Queen Street and Grays Road. It used to be a nurse's home, so what it is now, I don't know. But that's me.
So you went to school at...
I can always remember going to Mahora. I can't remember anything else. There was a couple of teachers that I liked there. I can't even think of their name. But from then on, it was always a central school, and didn't enjoy it one bit.
Did you play any sport when you were at school?
No, bugger sport. I've got no use for it then, and certainly no use for it now.
So at some stage or other, you had an interest in lawnmowers?
Oh, well, the old man made lawnmowers.
Yes.
And later life, I took over the franchise in Heratonga Street when my late brother Trevor died, who had the franchise. And I since married his wife, just my wife June now, and we were quite successful in business. We don't owe anybody any money.
And did you solely deal with Morrison motor mowers?
Yes, I did.
Nothing else, with a little Villiers motor on it?
Yes, they were the curly days, but I had a knack with two strokes. Nobody else in the world seemed to, and I built up quite a business on it. But dealing with the public, you tell them to use castor oil, and yeah, mobile in my car. Mobile goes in the mower, and they keep having bloody trouble.
So where was the shop then?
The first shop I operated in, it's where the, not the Countdown, what's that yellow shop, grocery outfit, opposite Tamona Road.
Pack and Say.
Was on there, where their Bowser Station is.
Right near Cudby's.
Yeah, Cudby used to be in King Street, and I believe he did shift.
Was it King's Auto Rentals? Was there a rental company beside where you were?
In those days, on Charles Street corner, was a section with a house on it, with a privet head, and then the AR Christians shop, and my shop was part of AR Christian. Then there was a dairy, and then there was a big building, which I thought supplied chemist stuff and stuff like that. But prior to that, I think your Cudbys or somebody you mentioned might have had it, because they did a lot of alterations to that building when the chemist part of it went.
Paul and Hodgins was there too.
Oh, they're diagonally across the road. 87191 was their phone number.
Is that right?
The amount of times that I picked up the phone. Paul and Hodgins? No, you're wanting 87191. What the bloody thing did.
Was your number very similar? Must have been.
87, because it wasn't 87 in those days, it was just 8191.
Yes.
We were 8711. It's on a bloody pencil or something.
So anyway, you not only you said you were very good with the Villiers motor, but you did sharpens and settings.
Oh, yes,
and rebuilt motors.
That was all part and parcel of the one shop,
yes.
Sharpening all those and so forth.
It was a very simple mower, wasn't it? Because just the little mower sitting up top with a shaft coming out, chain to drive the...
Yeah, well, of course, there's so many damn models. But the old man didn't like, he would prefer a shaft to come out and lady with long hairs get it wrapped up round the shaft. When J.H. Mason bought the place, the first thing he did was put covers over it, and that beautified the lawnmower.
Yes, yes.
But that basic model, really, they started off with Model A, which is the old original mower, which I've given to some, I don't know, I think it's in Waipawa somewhere, because that's a hell of a good museum, and that's where the mower is now. But the actual mower, being a decent mower, made of decent materials, didn't actually start until J.H. Mason's days.
Is that right?
Yeah. The blades in the reel in the old man's day were just basically one up on mild steel,
sure,
you know. Yes. And his theory was, oh, if you hit anything, it just bends the blade and it takes it away from the base plate. Because the reel was made, like Massport, for instance, their blades slope forward. And the heavier the load of grass you go into, the more they expand and the harder they come onto the reel, and the cleaner they'll cut. Whereas Morrison had its blade sloping backwards, and the theory was everybody hits kids' toys and everything else, and it bends the blade and it takes it away from the base plate. Didn't cut too well, but it took it away. With the rubbishy material that they were made of, probably was the best thing to do. Because if it was decent material, whatever.
You would have wrecked all the base plates.
Yeah.
Yes. So how many people did your father have? Was it like an assembly line in the factory where he made them?
Oh, no. Each person, there would be about two or three assemblers at peak times. And each person started from nothing to finish mower. And one thing I remember about assembling mowers, the frame in those days was just 8-plate side plates, and they had bars across it. The back one was the most offending one, and you'd nip the bolts up, and these bars that went across were cadmium plated. What cadmium is, I have no idea. I don't want to know.
Cheap sort of chrome.
I don't know what it was, but
it
affected the metal. I'm certain it did, because the amount of times you just tightened the nut on the end and the bloody end of the shaft fell off. And it never used to happen until it was...
Had this treatment.
Yeah, it never used to happen. And then, of course, you had to pull a whole bloody motor piece to put this bloody shaft back in. Sort of bugging up the program. But I wasn't on the assembly line, thank Christ. But I used to, when I worked at the factory, I used to sharpen reels. I used to be on capstan lathes. Like that job. I could go to sleep on that. Yeah, I'm not joking.
Just set it alight and it would just...
No. You brought the bar in and locked the collet chuck up to a stop and then to stop, and then you turn the head thing around and the next tool would go in and do it, and the next tool, and you'd get that bloody used to it. You just were asleep. I'll never forget. I lived to be 100. I used to count them to keep a tally on them. I had a scoreboard up here, and I used to take the thing out of the, when it was being parted off, whatever it might have been, and put it on the lathe bed. And I was going to count to 10, put a mark on the washroom, and slide them into a tin. And as I say, you just literally went into automatic. Now, I remember this day, tin was about half full. I was making the tap bodies. I used to make our own taps in those days. And I had 8 or 10 or something on the lathe bed. And somebody came along, I must have been way with the fairy, came along and took the tin, which was half full or whatever, took it away and put an empty tin there. When it came to 10, I slid the bloody things along, and of course it made a hell of a racket, woke me up with a bang. Oh. Christ, I just in an absolute cold sweat.
Yes, 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 yes.
I'll never forget that.
So did you learn your trade just by practicing?
Self-taught. Yes, self-taught. Yes. I learnt more at Hayton and Customs. I went there, I closed my repair bin that I had a guts full of everything. I owned the shop, and I decided, stuff it, I'll rent the shop, close the business. So I rang Hayden and Customs up and got hold of that Hayden, I think. I said, I'm looking for a job. If there's nothing to do, just twist a wire or something like that. Something I don't have to use my bloody brain on. I'm ready to go mad. How long? I said, oh, I bugger, I know. 12 months, I suppose. I was there for 10 years.
So what did you do?
Everything. Everything in the general. We did a lot of Morrison work, and then they were making those bicycles. Pity that damn thing didn't keep going, you know, because, you know, there's bicycle manufacturer in this country. And so anyhow, we used to make the carrier, the chromium carrier,
yes,
thing,
yes,
in the,
yes,
back. Oh, there was all sorts of wire work and stuff. And so I don't mind repetition work.
So when you were working for Hayden Customs, where was their workshop then?
You know, Harvey Norman is over the intersection and the next.
Did you ever work out at Morrison Industries?
No.
Because that, your father must have sold that, or...
J.H. Mason bought that.
Who from? Your father?
Clear, yeah.
And he took all the manufacturing of the mowers and the,
yeah,
the bikes?
Yeah.
And then he sold it to Wright Stevenson's, didn't he?
That might be the polite way of putting it. Wright Stevenson's, cunning bastards. Anyhow, that Wright Stevenson's, J.H. Mason was a bloke that knew no fear in business. Knew no fear. And Wright Stevenson's would back him. You know where Stuart Greer's garage is on the corner? Well, that used to be a store in the days I'm talking about.
Right.
And it was loaded with Morrison products right up to the roof.
Right.
And that was all promissory security for Wright Stevenson. And J.H. always ran right up to the bloody nostrils. But he made that bloody place spin, that's for sure. Bloody nice bloke. You know how he died? His son... He started PTY in Pitaru, and they had a big timber mill there, Pitaru Timber Yards. And the son, who was married in Australia, was brought out to run Morrison Industries, and he was a wood man, and he wanted to run PTY. And he would have made a bloody good boss out there. Not that I know anything about PTY. But J.H. was determined he was going to run Morrison's. And he just sat on his ass in a chair and appointed somebody else to do everything. Just was not interested. Bloody nice guy, wasted. Absolutely wasted.
Just wasn't a metal man. It wasn't any
metal.
No,
just no interest whatsoever. Yep. You could go down there any day of the week if Ian Mason was there and you were talking to him. You couldn't get away because you had nobody else to talk to. Everybody else was busy. Bloody nice guy.
And so what happened then? Did the company go belly up?
Oh, no. It was taken over finally by Wright Stevenson's, which was the inevitable. And they swapped Ian Mason for the property. They swapped land out at Rowpree, is it? It's further out than Rowpree.
Twyford?
No, it's further out than that.
Fernhill?
It's further out than that.
Terravale, Redcliffe?
It's straight out from Fern Hill. If you go straight out.
Okay, Pukeha Mama.
Yeah, in that sort of area. And Ian, of course, was highly delighted to get the hell out of the place. And property-wise or whatever, they swapped the factory for land out the back here. And Ian, everybody said, what's Ian dreaming about, you know? Bloody bit of wasteland. He turned it into a winery when winery wasn't as prevalent as it is today. And he was very successful with it.
Do you know what the name of the winery was?
Not a clue. Being a teetotaler, I'm not a wowser, but being a teetotaler, I wouldn't have a clue.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I think they had a cork in it. I'm not sure.
Good on you.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's where he ended up.
He established a great outfit out there.
He must have been at Coroquipo.
And he's had his own winery and everything out there. He was quite successful. His sons are still on it, as far as I know. So look up the register, you'll find Mason's out there somewhere, because he was very successful and a bloody nice bloke, wasted.
And so the chap Mason, what happened to...
J.H. Mason?
Yes.
J.H. Mason was a bloody fine man. I liked him. I liked him because he liked me. He thought the bloody sun shone.
Well, was...
But anyhow, I mentioned this Pitaru Timber Yard, didn't
That's
I?
That's right.
Well, he was at the Pitaru Timber Yards, and I don't know whether Ian was with him or not, but anyhow, he was browsing around there. And I don't know what sort of eyesight he had. I mean, he was driving a vehicle, but his lenses seemed to be a quarter of an inch thick, you know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he was having a look through Pitaru Timber Yard. And J.H. had to look into everything. He was interested in everything. And because the boss was going to have an inspection, they turned the bandsaws off. And the bandsaws are huge. When you switch them off, they might be still going in half an hour.
Yes,
they
I know.
A hell of a long time to stop.
Centrifugal force.
And J.H. had these very thick glasses and so forth. What the hell he was doing where he was, I have no idea, but he was down by where these big logs get cut
yes,
up
yep,
and all the
yep.
rest of it. And he tripped over some chips or some damn thing, and his glasses fell off, and he's blind as a bloody bat, and he's groping around trying to find his glasses. And he walked off on his own, I imagine, because I think somebody would have stopped him.
Yeah.
And he's walking straight in, looking for his bloody glasses, and blind as a bat, walks straight into the bloody bandsaw.
Oh.
Yeah. Survived for, several hours or days.
Yes, I remember him. We were involved with the Mason Village in Havelock. Our Rotary Club, we planted all the trees there when it was originally done.
Yeah.
But I think that may have been his widow.
Mrs. Mason, yes.
Because
yes.
he lived up in...
Arapata.
That's right. He was well-liked.
Oh, lovely bloke.
Yes, but what a way to end, though.
As I say, he had to be right in the middle of every bloody thing.
So, all right, then that means once the lawnmowers and everything went to Wrights and Masons, that was...
I don't know that actually Wright Stevenson did actually get it. I honestly don't know. I know there was an Australian manager put in.
And then there was Jim Judd, who was a New Zealand manager.
Was he?
Yes, from Hastings.
Jim Judd.
Jim Judd, managed it.
I didn't know he was in the managerial bit.
But those, those companies, they had so many people walking around.
Yeah.
You didn't know who was the boss, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so then you were doing some work still with Hayden Customs, and you stayed there for 10 years doing all sorts of things besides tying little bits of wire on things.
Yeah, well, I found Hayden and Customs a great life, hell of a good team, hell of a good team. In fact, I'm doing a bitch about this bloody road out here. It's the noisiest bloody road in Hastings. And it's all because the people that put it down shouldn't have a license for making roads because they haven't a bloody clue. And they've put half the shingle on it, they should do, and the road noise out here.
I know, it roars.
It absolutely unbelievable.
You can hear them from both ends.
And the newer the car is, the newer the tyres are, and the more the buggers roar.
A lot of the tyres that come in now from China and Japan are not designed for this sort of road anyway.
Oh,
they're cheap
and
they're noisy.
Anyhow, that's my latest bitch.
So anyway, you carried on there until you retired.
Yes, and they gave me, I must tell you this, they gave me a test dial indicator thing, and it was a thing like that, looked like a box with a handle in it and a little knob sticking out here. And if you push the knob, it read different things. And they're making a great bloody presentation about this bloody thing, you see. And I said, that's only half there, isn't it? And Custance says, what do you mean? Because I used to sit next to Custance at Smoko Tapes here, and this is where this bloody presentation was made. I said, bloody thing's only half here, isn't it? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, it's got to have a magnetic table that puts onto the outfit. We'll get you the other half.
That's
no bloody good like that.
So didn't they know that?
Of course they knew.
Yes, they were just having me on. Was Customs the short one or the tall man?
No, he wasn't very tall. I don't know whether Ray Customs ever had another jacket or whether he had a dozen exactly the same, but I never ever saw him in anything else but this bloody one jacket he had. Always wore it.
He used to live in Lane Road. He had the unusual house.
Yes, yeah. Bloody unusual, all right.
Was it?
He had the slack at work, and there was several Islander boys there. Jeez, they were nice blokes. Welding and that sort of thing. Anyhow, the frame was up, and I don't know whether they had wine netting on it or what the hell it had, but anyhow, it had to put, as the boys said, more mud, you know, and they were putting, smearing this bloody stuff on. There's coats and coats of it going on. And anyhow, apparently somewhere along that, I think somebody was installing, they're almost finished this bloody mud, somebody was installing something and brazing a pipe in the kitchen somewhere. And the bloody thing caught onto the wood or something, and the flames were coming straight up out the top like a bloody chimney. Oh, Christ. So anyhow, they were all there, and we had a hose and
fixed it up.
Bloody hose down the hole, flooded the kitchen.
I'd been in that house many times, not when Customs had it, but for other owners, I used to sell real estate, and it only fitted a certain type of person.
I could never get over that. That landing they had with no bloody handrail around the yard. Christ, talk about a suicide job. He didn't want any rails across.
That's how the architect in Wellington wanted it, though, wasn't it?
Oh, talk about bloody architects. If Customs wanted anything done properly, he always put me on with the bloke that's supposed to be able to do it. Anyhow, they had a great big sanding machine. They used to do furniture and stuff originally, and that was sort of all disused and still workable, but not used. And Customs decided that the ceiling in the dining room, I think it was, what the hell was the wood? Macro Carpa. And he wanted this all dressed. So we had this bloody great big sanding belt going and so forth, and we were putting this miles of wood, putting this stuff over this, and he'd come out and give it another one. So anyhow, we got this wood, and Mark Acapa's got a particular colour. It's beautiful. And this particular stuff, I don't know where the hell he got it from, but it must have been top notch, you know. And it really looked gorgeous. And I said, oh, you know, we've given it the third go over the sander, and it sure looks good. Look, come and have a look at it. Come out. Oh, no, he said, that's good. Now, polyurethane. I said, you bloody man. And he says, well, that's what the architect said. Well, I said, tell him to go to hell. I said, look at the gorgeous colour that's got. And he said, polyurethane. Well, I got a dab of polyurethane, and I touched the bloody corner of a piece, and it just went like any other damn good.
You lost the colour.
Went an orange colour. Yes. I went back into his office. For Christ's sake, come out and have a look at this. He said, what? I said, I've just put a bit of polyurethane on the corner of one piece of wood, and if that's what your architects want, I'd fire the bastard. And he said, well, that's what he said. And I said, well, come and have a look. So he came out and had a look. Oh, yeah. Well, I said, can't you see? That Mark Acapa's got it almost like a purpley vein goes through the bloody stuff. It looked beautiful. I said, can't you see that up on your ceiling? He said, well, that's where it's going. And I said, but Christ, you don't want it that colour. I might as well go and get a piece of Remu and stick up there. He looked at me in bloody disgust and says, do it. So we painted the bloody thing. God, it broke my bloody heart to see.
So it looked yellow, did it, when it was
It just went orange like other bloody wood does when you put... It's horrible bloody stuff. Yeah, that's been done with polyurethane, no doubt. It's orange.
Oh, so that was another skill you had.
Oh.
You were a woodworker as well.
He just gave me a pain in the ass over that job, just because the architect...
Yes.
I would have fired the bastard. What I've heard about architects, I used to go out to Price and McLaren's and Barney Barfoot or some name like that. There's only one in the telephone book in here. Barney used to run the ins and outs and magging to him there, and all of a sudden the bloody carriage pulled up and he said, oh, not this bloody architect. Hated the buggers, and he always wanted something bloody crazy. The crazier the better.
So you stayed there until you retired properly? Yep.
Oh, I've never stopped. You can't stop. You haven't seen my workshop, have you?
No.
I've got a factory out the back.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah. One of the fly presses from Hayden and Customs that we're going to throw it away. I said, Jesus, no, I'll take that back at the time. So it was pretty heavy. So I pulled the damn thing to pieces and took it round in pieces round to quality autos that
don't know where they are.
I use their washing machine and so forth. I used to keep their fan operative in their sandblasting outfit, and they apparently had plastic pin things in the fan arrangement, and of course the sand going through wore the bloody metal away at no time, and they're always having these damn things repaired or trying to find another pump the same, and of course they were getting older and older and harder to find. And so I made up a punch and die that a strip of metal was, say, that wide, it would bend a lug down every so often, and I made a fan thing out of it. And because making it out of metal, I could use metal, but I couldn't buggerize around with plastic. Anyhow, that I think I've only ever replaced one of those in all the years that I've been doing it. Never wore out. And so I've got free run of the washing machine and the sandblaster. I mightn't have all my workshop here, but I've got them around the place. Find me way around. It's not a matter of what you know, it's who you know.
So, Jack, you obviously got a lot of pleasure out of working with metal.
Oh, hell yes.
That was your forte. And as you said, you were self-taught, and you obviously could do any job. There was nothing.
Well, I'd have a bash at it anyhow. My youngest son, Ewan, I could watch that bugger all day. He's beautiful to watch. And some of the pieces of metal that he plays around with to fit this, I think, you know, it's not a hammer mark or anything left in them. Bloody beautiful. Watch him all day.
So where did he do his time then?
Well, he was at Hayden and Customs for quite a while. Went overseas to Australia with Hayden and Customs several times. Installation work.
I have a son who trained to be an engineer, fitter and turner, at Timona. And he has said, where he went to England after that, and he said no one realised what a great grounding they got at Timona on all types of engineering. He said he could do everything, and currently he works and lives in Kalgoorlie, Western Australia. He's a policeman there, but on his downtime he takes gangs into the mines for maintenance and repairs. But see, Garth gets about $90 an hour as a supervising engineer. But he just said, you know, a little place like Hawke's Bay, some of the teachers were very, very good.
No, I'll tell you one thing too. When I was at Hayden and Customs, they had an apprentice. And, I suppose you could put them in the bracket of louts. They weren't bad or anything, but they were just bloody louts. And they had to go to Terradale EIT. Has it always been called that?
No, it had another name.
Well, whatever it was. Yeah. That's where they went. Do you know they came back men? It was just unbelievable. No bloody skylarking,
no
stupid throwing things around the bloody workshop, and you know.
Bit of discipline.
Yeah, and I mean, not only that, they obviously realised what bloody idiots they must have been. They came back men.
Yes, so, well, that's fascinating to hear that. Do you still use a Morrison motor mower?
No, I use a Massport. I can't push a rotary mower back, but I just can't push it. And probably be a Massport if I did push his bloody mower. Anyhow, Eileen Woodham. Ray Woodham was my accountant.
Yes, I know Ray.
And friend.
You, Ray.
And friend. Do you know how he died?
I did know, but I've forgotten.
Apparently, they were going to go down south. A big trucking company that he founded virtually, as the accountant, had asked him, would they come up to their centennial so forth. A big outfit. And he was sitting on that couch over there telling us that he and Eileen are going to go down south. And I thought, Jesus Christ. I said, what, flying? Oh, hell no. He says, Eileen will do a bit of the driving. He says, I'll do most of it. I thought, Jesus Christ, I don't like that. So anyhow, I rang his son after they'd gone, and I said, you know your old man's going to drive down to Invercargill? He says, yes, he says, and I'm buggered if I know how I can stop him.
Was it Tully?
I forget. And he says, I'm buggered if I know how I can stop him. And I said, well, he's not fit to drive, that's for bloody sure. And so, not a distance like that. Christ, that's a long way. I ought to know. I've done it three times. But anyhow, the night before he was going to leave, I had a meal at home with friends. One of them was
a nurse or a female doctor, I'm not sure, I call her a nurse. And he was saying grace and so forth and sat down, and she was opposite him and she said, "You all right, Ray?" And then flopped his head into his dinner and that was it, he's gone.
Yes, because Keith Caron, who's a close friend of mine, was his partner. Peter Howell and those guys were, and so I used to spend quite a lot of time in their office, and I didn't know that.
No, that's how he died. Oh, quick as that. Dropped his head.
He was a really nice man, actually.
Oh, Christ, yes. One of the best. One of the best. Christ, we've had some fun.
Yeah. Well, if you're a teetotaler, how did you have fun with that group if you didn't drink?
Never had any bother.
They obviously accepted it and didn't try and pour it into you.
I can't ever remember any occasion anybody offered me a drink.
Maybe that's the problem. They thought you were teetotal.
I can't remember any such occasion that I was anywhere where they were drinking. But when we built this bloody house out at Frimley, I always admired... You remember a name, Eric Batson?
Yep, knew Eric very well. I knew his son Brian very well too.
Eric Batson had a very nice home on Tamona Road, and he had a long driveway, must have been a back section, he had a long driveway going in, very attractive. Came home to June and I said, "Look, I've seen the driveway I want. Come and have a look." I get in the car and drive around there. I said, "That's what I want." She said, "Looks very nice." So I got the red metal in and compacted the drive, and I remember the red metal arrived raining like hell on the Friday, and they dropped five bloody great big plops of this down the driveway, and there were no footpaths out the front in those days, just a mud pool. So I had to park the bloody car out on the mud, jump my way across the mud to get to Terra Firma, and looked at this and thought, Jesus Christ, what a job. So I put my gum boots on. This would have been about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I suppose. Come home from work quick. And it's pelting down. And I thought, well, I'm going to get bloody soaking wet anyhow, so I might as well just go out and reclose free and easy. So out I go with my rake. And I pull this bloody stuff round. And I finally got it down to the stage. If I did, I could drive the car in and put it in the shed. And I thought, no, bugger it, I won't bother. I was buggered anyhow. So the following day... Rain was still raining, but nothing like as heavy. And I gave it a final rake over, and a roller that's over on that fence line over there, backwards and forwards with this bloody hand roller, beautiful roller, about that diameter, cast iron. Rolled and rolled and rolled and rolled. Finally got it, just like the cat's whiskers, and said to June, "Well, there you are, there's Eric Batson's driveway." Had flash gate post put in and all the rest of it. And very pleased with it for about 6 months. And then we sort of noticed it was a little bit of a pothole here, and the puddle would splash out, and the puddle would get bigger and splash more out. The biggest bloody curse of a thing I ever had was this bloody limestone driveway. And I go back to Pomona Road and have a look at Eric Batson's drive, see what the hell he's doing about it. And he's got it all tar sealed. Christ, here we go. So I bought a drum, I prepared the surface again, two drums of tar, converted a watering can so it would fan out, and decided, okay, weekend, I'll get stuck in there. And lo and behold, Eric Batson came into my shop. He'd never been in my shop in his life before. "Oh, Christ, I see you've got tar seal on your drive." I said, "Limestone wasn't successful." And he said, no, bloody hopeless. And I said, "Well, I just got two drums of tar at home to break over and put..." "Oh, Christ," he says, "don't do that." He says, "I did that." He says, "I had to have it all scooped off again." He had agricultural equipment.
We'll see, that's right.
And he said, "No, don't, for Christ's sake, don't put tar seal on limestone." He says, "I can save you that heartache." He said, "It just doesn't work." So, oh, Christ, where do we go from here? And I had a nib of about 4 inches of concrete nib, which was the footpath this side and the garden down that side. And I wanted that nib originally. And he said, "No, for Christ's sake, don't put tar seal on that." He said, "Put red metal on it first." I said, "How much?" He said, "Oh, about 3 or 4 inches. Oh, Christ. Anyhow, I looked up the book and found somebody that carted red metal. And he came and had a look and he said, "Well, you want at least 3 truckloads there." And he said, "Christ," he said, "whether I can supply it or not." He said, "I don't know." He said, "I'm really scratching the bottom of the bin." And he had it on that main road out to Murakaku. And he says, It's going to be the last lot. I'll bring you what I can. So now he did get the 3 loaves and plenty of porridge with it. And rained like buggery when he delivered it, which was the best thing that could happen because I could roll it and rake it easy. Yeah. And got the base of a good outfit. And the following weekend, I tar sealed it. And that drive's still there.
Right.
And Ray Woodham says to me, you know, he says, every bloody thing you tackle, he says, turns out right, he says. Yeah, but Christ, there's a lot of hard work in that. And he said, Christ, he says, what about, he says, my drive, he says, it's all broken up and this, that and the other thing. He says, majority of it, he said, just wants another coat over top. He said, what about giving me a hand with my drive? And yeah, so that was the next weekend or a couple of weekends down the drain. But no, nice guy, all right.
Yes, he was. Now, just going back to the start again, what sort of man was your father? I know that you don't want to talk about him.
Well, I suppose you could put him down. He used to use the term engine idiot. And, you know, I used to think, oh, well, he means engineer, you know, that was his way of joke. But I think he was an engine idiot, really. He was a hell of a nice guy, you know.
But see, it's interesting that he was almost an entrepreneur with mowers, but then somewhere down the line you inherited that talent as well, didn't you? That engineering talent.
You had to, because I was in the middle of it all the time.
But I mean, it happened naturally with you. You didn't go and do an apprenticeship, you just had it.
Yeah, well, you're self-taught. I learned a hell of a lot at Hayden and Customs. I've got a machine shop, I'll show you before you go. I got a machine shop out there, second to none. It's a factory.
Yes.
Out there, and my bloody back was operated on, I'd be in my element, and I just can't. I go out there full of enthusiasm, 10 minutes, I'm back here sitting in the bloody chair again.
Did you ever know Jim Frogley?
Yes, the old man and Jim Frogley were very close. The old man bought very, very cheaply a car that the Pelletier McLeods bought for the boss, and it was called a Vulcan, 6-cylinder Vulcan. When it arrived at the Pelletier McLeods, it was running on 5 cylinders. So do what they may, they could not get that car running on 6 cylinders. And apparently, I don't know how the hell the old man was involved in it, but Jim Frogley, and I'm pretty sure the old man got hold of Jim Frogley, he must have been able to buy it cheap because it wouldn't run on 6, and the Pelletiers couldn't get it going properly. So the boss said, stuff the thing, get rid of it. And it was a big thing, and a bloody windscreen would have been about that high. The hood was way the hell up here somewhere.
Yes.
Because the old man says, first thing I'll chop that bastard down. And of course, he has to go the other extreme, driving through a bloody peephole almost. Anyhow, they carted this bloody thing out to Jim Frogley's, and it took them days to work it out. But it was the way it had a generator connected to the
starter motor. Water pump?
No, the distributor. And apparently this had an odd number of locations. And if you didn't get it in the right bugger, it didn't run on 6.
It missed one. There was a gap.
Yeah. That's simplifying the thing, but that basically was the main area.
Yes.
But anyhow, the old man apparently bought this bloody thing cheaply. And Jim Frogley, and he worked out how the eldest bloody thing was running on 6 cylinders.
So you just, when you're feeling all right, you use your workshop as a hobby, do you?
Oh, I make a product, I'll show you out there. I make a product, and I know F.L. Bones would love me to carry on making them, but 10 minutes out there and I'm buggered. You don't get much done in 10 minutes.
No.
And I just can't get these bastards. I've just been in the hospital for some other bloody thing or another the other day, and I was saying to this woman that was attending to me, and I said, oh, if I can get my bloody back fixed, I said, oh, I'm supposed to be on the operating list, and she got on the bloody computer, and she says, you're not, you know. So that was bloody cheerful.
Right?
Yeah, she says, you're not, you know. You just don't know what's going on. That. Mind you, poor bastards are flat out.
So apart from this using your engineering as a hobby. You're retired here, you don't play bowls or anything like that. You're just having a nice, easy retirement.
Some people would say that, yeah. I don't find anything easy with a bloody backache. Sitting on my ass here all day is not funny.
No,
there's plenty of things to do.
See, I can't even understand what it feels like because it's not my back that's hurting.
It just gives me hell. I go out and decide, right, I'll mow the back lawn. And sometimes I'll mow that, and then while I'm able, I'll open the bloody gate and mow the front one as well. But most times I mow one lawn at a time because the back gives me hell.
One thing I didn't ask you, your friendship with our friend from Australia who told me about you, what's his name? Travel agent? Did you ever do any travelling at all, Jack?
He's related to me, that bloke.
Oh, is he?
I'm trying to think what relation he is. He's married to my niece, one of my nieces.
You know, I haven't seen him for probably 10 or 15
years. Gary Muldoon.
Mulvana.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him for probably 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I walked into the Stonycroft, walked in, he's sitting there, and I said, "Hello, Gary." And he said, "Hello, Frank," you know. And then he started to say, I said, "Look, I've got this friend." He said, "You've got to interview him." He said, "This friend has got some good stories." So, no, that's good. Well, Jack, if that's pretty well everything you think you can remember.
It's a real hodgepodge.
No, it doesn't matter. But thank you very much for allowing me to record.
Yeah.
The life and times of yourself and your family, and I'd just like to say thank you.
My pleasure.